Welcome to Ukraine and Beyond and to my collaboration history series, Ukraine History in the Making. I'm your host, Emil, and over the next 4 months, Yevgenia Berutova.
History is one of the maybe most interesting subjects in the school curriculum.
Olena Dudko.
Without knowing your past, you cannot build the future.
Elisabeth Holvas.
I think that it is of the urgent importance to the world hear us and the world hear how devastating is the Putin's war.
And I will present the history of Ukraine as it was, as it is, and as it hopefully will be. Now let's get to the episode. Enjoy. Welcome to the first episode of Ukraine History in the Making. And I'm sitting here today with Yevgenia Fedotova. And my name is Emil, as always. And I guess you can say that I am sort of a host of the Ukraine History series that we're doing. But each time we will cover different periods of Ukrainian history. And maybe I'll just give the word to you straight away here, Jane. Present yourself and then also maybe share your thoughts about this whole project that we're doing.
Hello, everyone. So, Emil has said, my name is Yevgenia or Jane, and I'm vice president of the Liberal Democratic League of Ukraine. And that's how I ended up here in this podcast about Ukrainian history. And I'm very grateful that you're listening to us, and I believe that you will stay long with us, because with every episode, we will get closer and closer to nowadays, because luckily, you know what is Ukraine now, but what was Ukraine long time ago, it is what we will try to explain you, and also we will be very open to any questions that you will leave after listening to us.
And just to follow up a bit upon that, we can say that the aim of this history series is also to convey that the story of Ukraine is a story that is still in the making, as it always was. And that's also the reason for the title, which is Ukraine, a History in the Making. And if you listen to the prologue I did before, we are doing this show now with Olena, who will also be a part of the panel. We can have like, so me and you and Olena and Lisa, who will also be doing the show with us, we can have like maybe some diverging opinions upon the history. And when you draw the to like technically and concretely, I think we will also have some different views. But I think at least that what really makes the history of Ukraine so compelling at the time of being that we're in now is that it is a very historical time for Ukraine, because with the war and with the consequences of that and the magnitude of the influence, it is really a very important point in Ukrainian history, which is something I at least don't think you can say to the same degree about a country like Denmark, for example, because it is a bit difficult to imagine that Denmark will go through a similar period like the one Ukraine is going through right now. I don't know, can you maybe share some words about this, Yevgenia, that Ukraine is, I guess you can say, a country with a history that is much more active if you look at it in a certain light?
Yeah, I definitely agree that Ukraine is a country with very rich history and very dynamic history. And it can be explained not only by our population, that we are very freedom-loving and we are very enthusiastic about everything that is happening around, but also due to our geopolitical location. We are located just on the like middle of two of main trade routes in Europe. So the like parts of the Silk Road was laid like through Ukraine, and also like the trade way from Nordic countries to like modern Turkey or Byzantium back in days, it also crossed Ukraine. So that's why I believe this melting pot of different ethnic groups of different peoples, that's what's reflected in Ukrainian history, and that's what identified us as Ukrainians.
And I really hope and think also that with this history series about Ukraine, we will also tell that story about Ukraine being this melting pot among so many different cultures clashing at each other at the same time. And that's why I also look a lot forward to what you are going to talk about today, which is the period before Kievan Rus. So I guess you can say that in like the broad storytelling of Ukraine, a lot of people take their starting point on like Kievan Rus, because that's probably the first time that we see the formation of a state in the area of modern Ukraine today, which somehow resembles what a state is and also what the territory of Ukraine today is. But I think we should just go straight to it, Jevgenia, and then we will talk a bit about the discussion points we have also talked about with the whole group after, but let's just get to it. So this is the period before Kievan Rus, and you were the one doing the research. So what can you share with us?
So just as a spoiler, there will be like three groups that we will be talking today about. And I understand that maybe it's like, as you have mentioned, that like almost everyone started their research on Ukraine like from the Kievan Rus. Just because at least there are some resources, there are a lot of researches, books, materials, and whatever, but time we will be talking today, it is like 54th century before Christ, and closer to our days. So the first culture that I would like to start with is Tripilium culture, and in this title, it's already like one Ukrainian word, Tripilia. Like if you translate it directly, it is like three fields. And within this name, we can see an approach that these people took to their agriculture. Unfortunately, we are still living in climate crisis, so maybe this knowledge will be interesting for our listeners. And of course, like with the farmers' protest in the European Union, agriculture is again a hot topic. So what was this like three-field system? Not to extract too much, too many useful resources from the ground, like ancient Tripilians, they divided their resources like into three parts. And due to the first season, they cultivated like the first field. Then they changed it to the second season, and like one field was like kind of resting. And then on the third season, the third field was chosen to grow harvest. Again, and like this interchanging system gave them opportunity to harvest like more vegetables and grains and etc. And also they didn't over consume ground resources. Then from this like very caring agriculture approach, I would like to talk about their architecture and city planning. Unfortunately, I really would like our modern architectures to take advice from the ancient Tripilian culture, because unfortunately, city planning in modern Ukrainian cities, it is beyond crazy. There is no like one system, but it was implemented in the 55th century before Christ. So how like ancient Tripilian city looked like? It was like a concentrical city planning with not like straight streets that we are used to, but all cities are going in rounds, and they were ended on a like main square. And like one researcher said that it represented the circle of life and rebuilt of rebuilt and rebirth of life, but also it was more pragmatic to identify a hierarchy of people living in that city. So like closer to the city center, they were like nobility houses, and then like circles further from the center, it was like more peasants, let's say so. What's also important is the role of women in the society. Like if you have a look at like examples of the Trupilian arts, it will look like a very like curvy goddess. So all this philosophy about rebirth of life and circles of life, and also a very caring approach to nature, it also reflected in the art of Trupilian culture. So what researchers said about the Trupilian society is that it was very egalitarian society, and it wasn't patriarchal society. That was quite a progressive, I must say, for that time. And with all these flourishing and interesting details about their life, unfortunately, in 28th century before Christ, this culture stopped their existence. And there are like two main hypotheses why it happened. So the first hypothesis is that this culture was destroyed by force, and there was some invasion, and the force came from the east during their invasion to the west. And like for me, it's again like it reminded me a lot about Russia and their efforts to expand to the west. And the second theory, and actually it was formed by Blood Sernander, if I'm pronouncing these surnames correctly, and these scientists were from Denmark. Again, like a very surprising discovery for me, but still. So they explain that Trupilian culture had stopped their existence because of climate change. But the theory that they presented, it's a bit oversimplified, because on during the warm Atlantic period, that was during the existence of Trupilian culture, Denmark was occupied by Mesolithic culture, but Trupilian culture is already an example of Neolithic culture that unfortunately didn't lead to prove this theory. But anyways, like this climate perspective in early 20th century, it was very interesting and again progressive. So yeah, just to summarize, Trupilian culture is very ancient. So 55th century till 27th century of before Christ, they were quite egalitarian. They had a very caring approach to their ground resources. They tried to build their cities not only with a philosophical perspective, but also with city noble reflection of this architecture, and they unfortunately disappeared from the territory of modern Ukraine, Romania, and Moldova due to the forced invasion from the east.
Thanks a lot for that. And this is obviously describing something, a culture that is very ancient, and because that's like almost 6,000 years before Christ. So that's a period that most students probably don't even get to spend time at during school. But I remember at least that in high school, every like Danish pupil had to have this class that was called like ancient Greek science or something like that. And that is what it is reminding me of most when we do these very like early history things. Can you maybe, because a question I wondered was the sources for discovering the Thrapkilian and yeah, sorry for the pronunciation, but for the culture, what were like the first sources showing like the very earliest period, and why does it stop there where it does in like 27th century before BC? Did you find out something about that?
There are still like not a lot of sources, if there is a chance to visit Ukraine, I would recommend a wonderful museum that is located not far from Kyiv, and there are like two parts of this exhibition. One is like physical objects from the Tripolitan culture, and second is a territory where ancient settlements were located. Unfortunately, like right now, you won't see any fundaments of old houses and etc. But still, like you can imagine a territory where everything has started. So there are some Romanian historians who worked on this topic, and currently I know that there is an active knowledge exchange within UNESCO between Ukraine and Romania, and there are some efforts to draft this common perspective and parts of common history together. So there will be like no one-sided, let's say so, representation of the development of this culture. But again, since this culture is very ancient and there are no written evidences of this culture, there are no 100% like iron-proofed theories why this culture has stopped their existence. But again, like as I mentioned before, the most credible and the most realistic theory was formulated by archaeologist Maria Gimbutas. So yeah, that's like she formulated that it's disappeared because of the forceful invasion.
And that Ukraine is an ancient independent nation. Ukraine has a history of more than 1,000 years. Kyiv was a major metropolis and cultural center when Moscow was not even a village.
And I think that will lead us on to the second period, or the second culture inhabiting the lands of modern Ukraine that you will talk about. And maybe before you get to it, because the next culture that we're going to talk about is like the Scythians, and they didn't start until the 7th century BC, right?
Yes. 8th and 7th century.
Yeah, around that time. So that's quite a leap in time, going from the Thrapkilian culture until this that we're going to talk about now. So maybe if you can first, do you have some thoughts about what's happening in the period in between? Or is that just a period with no sources to subtract knowledge from?
No, there are peoples that were later called as Cimmerians, Cimmeriti in my native language. But again, I believe it's too privileged from my side to tell that they were not as developed as groups that we are going to talk about today.
Okay, so the, I guess the like the reason why we are talking about the Scythians as the next is because maybe that the culture and the people from the period in between didn't leave behind the same legacy, making it possible to talk about like this, which is something we see all around the world, by the way. So that is by no means isolated to Ukraine. But yeah, then I guess let's just go on with the Scythians, which I can't wait to hear more about.
Sure, and again, just a disclaimer, I don't want to leave anyone behind, but just the Ukrainian history is so intense, so that's why like we just propose you creme de la creme from the history of Ukraine. So, like in comparison to the Tripilian culture, Scythians were nomadic people. So they didn't just appear on the territory of Ukraine, they actually came from southern Russia. And they settled in Crimea, that is like south of Ukraine now. And like again, disclaimer, their empire were overtaken by Sarmatians. And Sarmatians is the next group we are going to talk about. But now back to Scythians. So what they are famous for? So first of all, they are first to master riding, and what is like again like interesting approach to this horse riding is that they set like horse back, and that's how like they were more effective in battles. So also Scythians were not just like excellent warriors with very inventive style of war, but also they were skilled craftsmen, and especially in gold. Again, just like a bit of off top, but last year I was in Colombia, and there is like a great museum of gold in Bogota. And you know, like when you think about the 8th century before Christ, what kind of ornaments you can imagine? They are like more or less simple. Like, okay, like you can guess that it is a bear, it is a warrior maybe, but what really made a difference for Scythian art is that it is extremely detailed. And again, just to make a parallel with a fashion, it was like very like statement pieces, and like all Scythians had some gold, and they took some like jewelry. But the higher your position was in the society, the chunkier your accessories were. And like the most famous example of Scythian art, it is a golden pectoral, and it is like a necklace that goes into layers, and like each layer is dedicated to a certain class of Scythian society. So like you would see warriors, you would see some farmers, you would see horse riders, and again like it's like super detailed, and it was like really marvelous to see such a craftsmanship in the 7th century before Christ. So where can we find these examples? So first of all, we can find them still in burial mounds, or how they called kurgans, and in the south of Ukraine there are still some kurgans that of course like they were discovered and there are no more treasures in it. But it is, okay, it was before the full-scale invasion of Russia to Ukraine. It was quite a like regular destination for some school trips. Like just go over weekends and take part in this history reconstruction processes. Also, I would like to say that Scythians are still like influencing us through their art. And there was a dispute between Ukraine and Russia for whom this gold and for whom these exhibits of art belong to, and like how the situation went. In 2014, Ukraine gave these exhibits to the Netherlands to show them in, let me check, what was it? It was Museum of Alert Person. In case anyone from the Netherlands will listen to us, please correct me if I didn't pronounce it correctly. So, and so from 2014, all these exhibits were stored there. But Russia, after annexation of Crimea, they started claiming that, like, no, according to our Russian constitution, Crimea is a part of Russia. So everything that was found on the territory of Crimea and everything that was placed in the museums of Crimea, it belongs to us. Luckily, in June 2023, the Dutch court has made a verdict that these exhibits are Ukrainian, they belong to Ukraine, and they will give these exhibits back to Ukraine. And also, again, like, I believe that the full-scale invasion has played its role, but the fine that the museum put on Ukraine because of, like, exceeding periods of securing these exhibits, this fine was just cancelled. So, yeah, it is very, like, honorable gesture from the Netherlands. And again, like, now, like, we are talking about, like, culture, art, etc. But, like, what is money behind this art? All exhibits, they are worth more than one and a half million of euros. Again, maybe it's not as big sum for our, like, European listeners, but believe me, for Ukrainians, it is quite a huge sum. And it is, again, some battle that Ukraine wants to win over Russia on the cultural front, if you use such phrase.
So, yeah, that last thing is very telling, I guess, about how history also in so many ways plays into the current state of affairs between Russia and Ukraine. And one of the things that we also want to do with this history series is to combat misinformation. So that will be all the misinformation you hear whenever Putin, Carlson, and other pseudo-historians, they ramble on about Ukraine, Russia, and so on. And yeah, to this point, maybe it's important also to say that we are not professional historians, like the two of us, also not Lisa and Olena, but what we at least think that we are trying to do is to share a perspective on history that is related to the sources as much as possible, and that therefore is not we're not embarking on the, like, the arena of non-history, I guess you could say it like that, or pseudo-history. But while being clear about that, we also need to say that we are not professional historians. So we're just doing the best we can. But concerning this point about Russia trying to steal these exhibitions and all the money that goes along with it, and the reason why I bring in the perspective about misinformation here is that I don't think that I've ever heard Putin, for example, explicitly talk about this period. But you're saying that yet they are still trying to say that these exhibitions belong to Russia, although it is actually something that is related to a point in history that goes way beyond, like it's much earlier than the point of history from which Russia usually justifies their territorial claim on Crimea. Do you have some thoughts about that, about like why would they still try also in international court to claim this stuff, although the point of history that they are from is actually from a point of history earlier than the one from which they they usually make their territorial claim on Crimea?
So again, like I don't want like to mix like late medieval history and like our current episode, but currently I'm reading a book that is called Imperial Knowledge by the author of Eva Thompson, and she pointed out that like Russia, like as Russian Empire and whatsoever, they had struggle with their like with the like creation of their traditions. Like before Russian Empire, the masterpiece of Russian literature and Russian culture was a book that is called Domostroy, and it is like mostly like the first part is dedicated to how you should respect God, go to church, and etc. And second part is dedicated to some advice for your household. And like Domostroy is like basically household or how to manage household. And I believe that the reason, no, it's not the reason, it's like it's one of outcomes of imperialism, is that Russia is trying to digest more ancient narratives or more ancient histories of countries that it wants to conquer one day. So, and for me, it's a bit a paradox, because Russia, like right now, they doesn't like they say that Ukraine can't exist. It has no like historical basis for its existence. But at the same time, they try to steal some pages from our history and rewrite as their own, just like to make this Russian imperial history a bit longer and connected not only to medieval European history, but even like dated back to Roman Empire, to Greek Empire, and etc. So yeah, it's just a cultural redigestion and untamed hunger of Russian imperialism. But yeah, like again, like going back to the beginning of our podcast, you said that when people start learning about history of these territories, they don't go like as far as we are starting today. No, they start like, okay, like 6th-7th century of like AD. But and that's why like I believe that Russian propaganda is also oriented to some like Western audiences. So they just don't want to overcomplicate maybe their reasoning, because again, like I didn't listen to the Putin's interview to Tucker Carlson, but like the flow of his speech was so intertwined, sometimes very illogical, and etc. And just imagine that he would have started from like 55th century before Christ. It would like last forever, and he wouldn't be successful in conveying his message. like when you started, like in 17th century with this legend that Ukraine and Belarus wanted to rejoin with their Russian brothers and sisters, maybe it's just easier for people to digest. So yeah, like,
and I just think it's a very interesting coincidence that they are trying to claim these exhibitions from Crimea, but that these exhibitions actually date back to a period that is so much earlier than from the point which they make their claim. But as you also suggested in the beginning, it could have something to do about Russia, like current Russian regime, and maybe Russians historically as well, that they just like to see Crimea as have also been Russian even in that period, and therefore it probably makes sense for them to claim these exhibitions. But obviously it does not fit the general narrative that Putin is also trying to convey, and yeah, is talking about in his interview with Tucker Carlson. So maybe it's a sort of mix up in their propaganda, even to a certain degree, where they are kind of exposing why their overall narrative isn't correct either, or at least that it doesn't follow the way they then historically, politically are acting on the international stage when it actually comes to claiming the rights of things. But also I just think in general, it's very good that you mentioned this contest over these exhibitions, because it just shows also how history is always important, especially within geopolitics, because there are things all over the world that are contested by so many different nations. And I think that we will see also throughout this series how much of a theme this is, with Russia trying to claim stuff that is actually rightfully Ukraine's, and so on. But I think with all this, you can make some comments on what I just said if you want to, but otherwise we should probably head to the last period that we will be talking about today.
Sure, but I really want to make some like very short comments. Like one concept exists in Russia that is like a blindless respect towards past leaders. So, like right now, people are glorifying Stalin for his acts of just like pure madness, I believe. But before, like Stalin and so all emperors, there was a Catherine the Great, and she had Greek project, so-called Greek project. And what was this project about? So she wanted to find traces of a connection of territories that she conquered with the ancient Greek. And like, you know, all this myth that Moscow is the third Rome and etc. So this Greek project was about renaming cities just so they can sound more Greek. So that's how we ended up with cities that is ends with Pol, like Mariupol, Melitopol, and etc. So all these toponyms, they are like of Greek origin, but they are not naturally named by local people. It was just like a decrees from Catherine the Great to rename the cities.
Okay, so it was like an attempt from Catherine the Great to, or at least that's how some people title her, it was an attempt by her to bridge essentially old Greek culture with, in her eyes, like Russian culture within this new conquered area.
Yes, indeed. And like, what is the connection with the modern Russia is that Catherine the Great is still a good ruler as like Russian textbooks tell us. So that's how, like, if Catherine the Great thought that we need to prove that our culture is connected with Greek culture, we need to find some like real examples of this connection. And Scythian art could be such example.
Yeah, and like we really need to get going to the next period, because we're also on a time restraint, sort of. But I just want to mention very quickly here now that we are focusing in on this specific theme about Catherine renaming these cities, trying to connect Greek culture and like imaginary existing Russian culture. And I really think we need to delve deeper onto the subject in another episode. But I just increasingly see that people from like the nationalistic right in Europe, they latch on to this narrative about Russia being like the continuation of the Third Rome. And actually, I was seeing some videos, I think today and yesterday, where a historian, sort of like a freelancer on YouTube, who I think some of his videos were all right, but he really stepped into this narrative of this being like Little Russia or New Russia or something like that. So I just think it's important that we are aware of the fact that there is actually a narrative out there that is gaining a lot of ground on the far right in European countries, and also in the United States, I think. And I think that was also, maybe it is a result of, and also just the story that Putin wanted to tell in his interview with Carlson. So I think that will be interesting later, but it is just very revealing that we already now see the traces of this. But yeah, let's get to the next period now, Jane, which is like the last period we will be talking about today.
Kyiv was not ruled by Moscow. They were not part of the same political entity. For centuries, Kyiv was looking westwards.
Yeah, so I'm encouraging everyone to stay with us until 18th century episode, because that's how we will get back to this Catherine the Great topic and etc. But now back to the third group. They were called Sarmatians, and they were part of Scythian culture. But there was like a wider Scythian culture that incorporates Scyths and some tribes that wanted to be associated with them. So again, Sarmatians, they are also nomads. They came from Eurasian steppe, and then they migrated like further to Danube River, that is like Hungary, modern Hungary, Wisla River, that is modern Poland, and some parts moved to Volga River, that is in Russia. So you just can imagine the huge areas that Sarmatians controlled. So now it's time for some like fiction and legends, because the Sarmatians were known because of their connection to legendary Amazons. And Herodotus, who is the like history, who is a father of Greek history, he wrote that Sarmatians are descendants of Scythian fathers and Amazon mothers. It is very romantic legend, I believe. There are no proofs, but still. What's interesting about Sarmatians is that within their society, there were a lot of female warriors. Again, like, it's super empowering as for modern feminism representatives. And also, unfortunately, we see the repetition of history again in Ukraine, in modern Ukraine, because currently there are more and more females who are joining Ukrainian armed forces. And they are not only like people who working in some far from the front location. No, there are also snipers, there are also artillery shooters, they are drone pilots. So yeah, like history repeating in Ukraine, but with different details. So what else is interesting about Sarmatians is that they were quite friendly with German tribes, and they formed alliances against the Roman Empire. But the Roman Empire warriors were really fascinated by the quality of protections, of tactics, of cavalry. And with all this fascination, Roman Empire had overtaken Sarmats, and also they invited them as a part of their army. And there are some evidences that Sarmats were sent to Roman Britain, and if I'm not mistaken, Lancashire, something like that city. The museum in that city still has some remnants of Scythian armor and etc. In there. So there are some evidences that these people were so great in fighting against Roman Empire and for Roman Empire. So they were sent far, far away. So also, how their history ended, because again, they were quite successful. They came on the territory of modern Ukraine, in the second century before Christ, and they had quite a good life on this territory by 4th century of our times. Unfortunately, then the Huns came on the territory of modern Ukraine, and the subsequent migration led to assimilation of Sarmatians in other cultures. So they lost their, distinctive identity, and they were just dispersed between neighboring countries. And again, we can say, okay, narrative of powerful women in the army, it is the only legacy that we have in Ukraine from them. But I just want to bring one example of other European country, Poland, who used history of Sarmats as well. So in the 16th century, medieval Europe, the Polish nobility claims to stem from Sarmatians. And it's not only reflected in their genealogical trees, but also if you see portraits of the members of nobility of those times, you would see specific style of their clothes and even some of some of elements of power, like scimitars and etc., they were designed in the Sarmatian style. Sarmats influenced history not only Ukraine, but also history of Poland, and they were dispersed for almost 6 centuries on the territory from Hungary to Poland, covering Ukraine and to Russia. So it was huge territory controlled by them.
Yeah, so that was our last period that we would particularly cover. Is there anything from this period? You said that they were also nomads, so they were also traveling people, I guess you can say, and this also goes for the fact that they covered so much of European territory. Is there anything you would like to add about how they came to an end? You said something about the invasion by the Huns. Can you maybe talk a bit about what happened there and who the Huns were?
So the Huns came from the territory of modern Mongolia, and like even the Roman Empire has suffered from the Huns in like 5th century. Unfortunately, there is like no comparative analysis of strategies of the Sarmatians and the Huns, so I can't say like what was the main fault that led to a tragic consequence for the Sarmatians. But the fact that some of warriors were sent far from their homelands and territories that they were supposed to protect, I believe it also led to a weakened positions when it came to the face attack by the Huns. And unfortunately there are no written evidences from the Sarmatian perspectives. Like, we can find some traces in the Greek books, like about their warfare and about their habits, like when it came to some camping style and taking care of their armor. But unfortunately, there are not a lot of resources for their internal culture research.
No, but so the Huns came from the east, and they came from the same territory that would a few hundred years later also invade like the country or the territory of today's Ukraine. So do you think that this Hun perspective also plays into a general theme of the Ukrainian territory being invaded by some power from the east? Do you think it's fair to say that, or is that a history that will mainly come into play later?
Again, like I can't oversimplify and say that Ukraine was always invaded like from our neighbors from the east. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be fair, because like Ukraine was attacked by Turkey, by Poland. Like, we were part of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and of course, like, it was more peaceful process of integration, but still we didn't have our independent state within the Commonwealth. Yes, again, like, history is repeating itself, but I still can see some familiar tactics by the Russian army and Huns. Like, if we talk about just like mad damaging of homes, or just like raping women and etc. So it happens the same when Huns came. But for me, it's a mystery, like, why people in the 21st century can't overgrow such approaches. As Sarmatians integrated in neighboring countries and in neighboring ethnic groups, I can see Ukrainians also are doing right now. So some of them are migrating to Poland, Germany, and etc. And they want to assimilate and start their lives there. So yeah, unfortunately, tragic history is repeating itself.
And you're saying that history is both repeating itself, looking at the tactics and the atrocities committed by the invading army in the period of time we are talking about, that's the Huns. And it also is repeating itself in terms of the flow of people, like migration and people fleeing. So that's also something I find so how can you say, like, attractive about learning history and about using history when talking about contemporary events, because we see so many times during history like the same patterns occurring, and that goes for almost any period you would compare. And also it works both on location and time. So of course some things are pretty specific to Ukrainian history, for example, but you could also look upon other countries that has been invaded throughout history, where you would see almost the same mechanisms being at play. But I think, so we have these different points that we talked about wanting to appear as general themes in all the episodes. And this is the first episode, so I think we can round off, Yevgenia, by me just asking you 5 questions, each of them being related to one of these points. And yeah, you should probably answer as short as possible. And then this will just be like a quick fire today. And then we can see moving on how we can like implicate all these themes into each episode. By the way, a lot of the themes will already have come into play just naturally. But let's just go here. So the first question I want to answer is the geography, like the geography and the territory that you have been covering today, like what territory the Scythians and so on inhabited. What is the most direct line you can draw from what you have talked about today, and then the things we see play out in the making of Ukrainian history as of today?
Okay, so if we talk about territory, I can say that from the north, it starts from the Kyiv region. Then, like, we go, like, through the whole central Ukraine and down to Crimea. From east, we have, like, Donetsk and Zaporizhzhia region covered within this episode. And from the western part of Ukraine, it is like neighboring territories to Romania, that is Chernivtsi region.
And let's go on to the next one straight away. Is there like a general thing from the period that you have covered today that you really think stands out as something we should be like especially aware of, like a general theme or something like that?
So I believe that, again, like it's not a consequences drawn by historians, it's consequences drawn by me, by activists. So I believe that from all three groups that we were discussing today, modern Ukrainians took their like own values. So from the Tripelian culture, I would say egalitarian culture and very caring approach to the ground and everything that is coming from the ground. From Skiffs, we incorporated this craftsmanship and probably creativity. And from Sarmats, we somehow inherited their warrior state of mind and their tradition of engaging women in their army.
And you can answer this the way you want and also like dismiss the question, but it is this question about how we see the colonial perspective throughout Ukrainian history. So like a general theme, especially moving forward, will be like the Russian colonization of Ukraine. But is there anything already in this very early period of Ukrainian history that we see this like suppression and oppression?
So modern Russian colonial mindset is very keen on the southern parts of Ukraine. And we are not talking only about Crimea, but also about Odessa region, Kherson region, Mykolaiv region, and Zaporizhia region. So as you may have seen some maps in 2022, like this corridor from Russia to Crimea covers all of territories where Sarmats and Scythians lived. And by capturing these territories, Russia gives a mark that everything that has happened on this territory belongs to Russia and it was Russian, even if word Russia didn't exist at that time. So I would just like us not let Russia rewrite history, not only in academia discourse, but also in like her usual life. So like if you can raise awareness that Russia is stealing some art objects from Ukrainian museums on occupied territories, this is like mainly again southern part of Ukraine, please just raise awareness, try to bring this to attention of some cultural institutions, and maybe with this society push, we can ask Russia to pay back.
So in that way, the colonial perspective from the Russians concerning already this period is actually not that they historically were already suppressing Ukraine in this period, but rather that now today they are trying to, with their politics of history, to suppress what is the actual story about what is now Ukraine by somehow claiming that these periods, even dating back to the period that you were talking about, should somehow be considered more Russian or something like that. So yeah, that's also an interesting thing, that even history that is beyond the reach of what was or is Russia, they're still kind of colonizing, I guess. And then we have a fourth theme, and that's the one on the continuation of Ukrainian history. And I don't really know how to give the word here to you, but I guess the shifters we also got from what you were talking about kind of speaks to the dynamics, I guess, of Ukrainian history. But can you in any way like bridge the continuation we see today of Ukrainian history, like the dynamism and so on, to what you were also talking about?
Yeah, sure. So I believe that such ancient history of the territory of modern Ukraine gives us a field for international cooperation with our neighboring countries like Romania, Hungary, etc., even Poland. And also these ancient pages prove that Ukraine is Europe. Like, we are belonging not only because of our values that we have nowadays or our economic aspirations, but we are culturally and historically already integrated in that sphere. So, I believe it's just not only continuation, but it's our restoration. We are restoring our place in the European history. So, that's how I would summarize why this period is important and why it has continuous impact on the modern Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think that's a nice way to kind of wrap up this first episode of Ukraine, a history in the making. So Yeah, thanks a lot for the contribution today, Jevgenia or Jane. I guess here at the end, I just want to say to all the listeners that I hope that you all find it interesting, and please share it if you want to. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate, do not hesitate in terms of writing to me or Jane or the others that will also be a part of this project. I look forward to also getting to some of the like more recent periods of history, because that's what I probably mainly know about. But I really think that it's a nice way to start so early on. Do you have any remarks going out here?
No, just please stay with us. Please listen our podcast till the episodes of the period you are super interested in. And thank you so much for your interest in Ukraine. Slava Ukraini.
And then I say, Heroyam Slava.
Yes, perfect.
Nice, that was good. Yeah, so anyways, thanks for the episode today. And yeah, listen along the next time where we will be covering the period leading up to the formation of Kiev and Rus. And that will be Lisa bringing the story and doing the research and everything. So I look forward to that. Hey, that was it from this week's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed it and that you will follow along as we make our way throughout Ukrainian history. Besides that, I want to encourage everyone to find us on social media. There are links in the description. On social media, we will also post some videos and make some reels to make all this a bit more interactive and easier to follow for you guys as well. So yeah, if you find us there and see the videos and reels, please also share on your own social media platforms. It's in that way that we spread out the history of Ukraine to as many people as possible. Slava Ukraini!